Hello, cyclocross friends, and welcome to episode 107 of Crosshairs Radio. On today's show, we have Jeremy Powers. It's been a while since we've talked to Jeremy Powers, so it was awesome to catch up with him. Always have great conversations, and this is no exception. You know, with the season coming to an end here with cyclocross, we had an awesome year. Mainly of they don't do that in Europe panel discussions with Mr. David Palin and also with Scott Diedenbach. And now that we're sort of rolling down with the racing, I wanted to get back and have some more of these one-on-one conversations. And there was no better place to start than with Jeremy Powers. So we talked about Aspire, we talked about Worlds, and just the season and his career. And as I said, it was great to catch up, and we're going to get to that conversation here in just a moment. But before we do that, I do want to talk about Health IQ and the Health IQ quiz. It could be the cycling quiz or one of their lifestyle quizzes. Basically, if you go to healthiq.com/cxhairs, you can take this quiz, and that's how you qualify for savings. And you can pay less on your life insurance because of how you answer the questions on this quiz. It's pretty good deal. And I know all of you all will do great in it. So Health IQ, life insurance company, and the Health IQ advantage is that they have this unique mortality model. And it's based on the health conscious. And they look for people who take care of themselves, eat right, and exercise. And those are the type of people that they can get lower rates for because they're a better risk. It's kind of like being a good driver and getting a lower rate on your auto insurance. If you're a good person in how you take care of yourself, then you're going to get a lower rate on your life insurance. They do things like they replace BMI with waist-to-hip ratio. They do different cholesterol calculations. They really look at a more modern way of evaluating health and fitness. And they put that towards what they are going to charge for life insurance. Crosshairs Radio, the show you're listening to, is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, weightlifters, and vegetarians get lower rates on their life insurance. So you should go to healthiq.com/cxhairs to support the show and see if you qualify. You can also mention that promo code CXHairs when you talk to a Health IQ agent. All right, next up, I want to talk about the Wide Angle Podium Podcast Network. That is what Crosshairs Radio is a part of, and it's something that I would love you to be more involved with. You can go to wideanglepodium.com/donate, become a member, low as $5 a month, and up from there. We're doing really cool things with the podcast network. I know I've talked to them to death, but I just want to reiterate one of the things is sponsoring Katie Compton, and that's going to go on for this whole year. So we're really stoked on that, especially after the amazing year that she had, national champ, Pan Am champ, second in the world. I mean, just champ. Just a wonderful year, and we're really excited to be a part of that. Also, if you didn't see it on social media, we were able to donate all the money from our t-shirt sales to different animal shelters around the country, those that have been affected by natural disaster. So that was a really cool thing to do, not just cycling, but we're trying to do good things in the world. And all you have to do is become a member, and then you get to support all of the shows that we have. One you're listening to, Crosshairs Radio, Honest Bicycle Program. I just guested on there. It was awesome to hang out with Greg and Dan Jabanov, and that show should be up soon. So check that one out as well. We got to hang out doing some awesome things up there in the Pacific Northwest. Check out that show along with all of the shows on the network. Once again, go to wideanglepodium.com, click on that donate button, and become a member. Last piece of business I want to touch on real quickly is that every Wednesday in the month of March and also the first week in April, we're putting on our garage racing again. Crosshairs Garage Races takes place in Crystal City. Crit style bike racing on two levels of an underground parking garage. It's an awesome time. It's a good party. We have a happy hour going on at the same time. You can find out more information at bikereg.com/crosshairsgarageraces. Would love to see all of you out there if you're in the DC metro area, or even if you want to travel down. Come on down. It's a good night. It's a good time. Okay, that's enough yapping here. Let's talk to Jeremy Powers, and let's do that right now. Hey, Jeremy, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Bill. How are you?
I am doing just fine. Before we started recording, I was explaining to you what TDD-TIE meant. And it really is, and I think we've had these conversations before in the past where Americans who are very into cyclocross, they look at that European cyclocross and specifically Belgian cyclocross as sort of this gold standard, you know, that everything those guys do, we should be doing too. That's the whole thing. And if we see something in the U.S., and this is where it started, you know, you see something in the U.S. that somebody has on their course that just doesn't seem like cyclocross to you, whatever it may be. I heard at one point somebody said, well, they don't do that in Europe. And then after that, I would always say, well, those guys over there in that super prestige race have a pump track in the middle of their course. That doesn't seem very cyclocrossy. So that I always like, well, they don't do that in Europe, you know, or whatever it was when they put that pinwheel in there. Well, they would never do that in Europe. So it was just sort of like knocking down that, hey, those guys are just doing the same thing we're doing. They just, you know.
I had to look up some of the acronyms, and yeah. I'm the king of acronyms. I love acronyms, but I had to look up a couple. Like, I'm old. Like, we use different things. Like, now stuff is, you know, sick AF, and you're like, wait, what is that? Sick AF? Like, is that like, are they talking about Alfie? Like, what are we talking about right now? Like, yeah. I gotta go in and
you're
dig
not,
in.
You're not allowed to say you're old, though.
No, I'm not, but I'm serious that like some of the phrases that I use, I see older people using now, and I'm like, ugh, that was like, I used to say that. Okay, all right, I gotta get in with the kids. True though, the people that I hang with are, you know, 15 years younger than me now, in some cases, so I have to pay attention a little bit more. Yeah. But you're right, they do things different in Europe. That's a fact, and that's a good acronym that you guys have. I'm just saying that I had to look it up when I first saw it.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
I appreciate you following along regardless.
Yeah. Yes.
No, it's funny with the age thing, though. That's actually something that I caught myself doing recently that I think, even like in the last year or so, that has sort of changed my outlook in that I won't allow myself to say that as either in a joke or a cop-out, oh, I'm just old.
Right.
So I'm like, no.
Yep. Well, you're not. You're not. That's the truth. I mean, really, we're living longer. We should.
Yeah.
Things like really 30 is the new 20. I mean, you're just getting going at 30.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've also, you know, at least for me, and since you've been around the cycling world for a long time as well. Now it's still, even though you may be getting older in age, it still keeps you young. And still, as you're saying, you know, hanging out with people 15 years younger than you, that kind of stuff, it's good. I think it's a great thing. So I think it keeps you active.
Absolutely. Yes. And hanging out with our 7-month-year-old son also keeps you young.
Yeah. So how is fatherhood going?
Fantastic. Yeah. It's a totally different type of, it's a totally different type of effort. You know, for me, the only thing is just the sleep part of it, like the 2 a.m. to 3 a.m., like wake up and then letting them cry or feeding them or whatever the process is. But I really am totally in love with our little guy, and we're having a blast, and he's so much fun to do stuff with, and he's always smiling, and he's learning how to crawl. He's like, basically looks like he looks like he's in the army. He's just crawling around with his, you know, dragging his legs behind him right now, trying to get to the dog's toys and put things in his mouth and teeth and all of those stuff that's happening. So the whole phone is filled. I'm sure anyone that has a kid knows this. Your entire phone is now filled with pictures of your kid, and no one else thinks they're cool, but you do. You're like, we're showing baby pictures right now. Whether you like it or you don't, I want to look at them.
Yeah. And the whole mobility part of it, that's a whole, you know.
Yes.
You look back on those first couple months when they can't move around. You're like, oh, that was good.
I'm scared. Trust me, I'm scared. Once he starts motoring, he's already has one of those things where he can just put his feet through and he can kind of, it holds him up and he can walk with it or roll with it.
Yeah.
And the dog has been terrorized.
I'm sure.
Nothing is sacred anymore. Not breakfast, not anything. Nothing is, So it's going to be a trip. That's for sure.
Yeah, we yeah, and I understand the sleep thing. Although we got lucky, like I think our first kid slept. She slept through the night pretty early on, and yes. And then when we had our second daughter, I was like, "Oh, this is gonna be payback," and she slept even more. She was like a college student by the time that she was, you know, three. It's like, I need my 15 hours of sleep.
Yeah, he is. I mean, I know other stories from my friends where there has been much worse for them. But for me, it's not bad. But when you're a pro athlete, anything's bad if you're up in the middle of the night. So, you know, if I'm up for 15 minutes going to the bathroom, I'm like, I better mark that down in training peaks. But for, you know, when you're up for an hour because they're hungry or they're bursting teeth or whatever, or they've got a dirty diaper, it's like all those things are they seem like they're bigger than they are, but to regular people who have kids, it's probably not even a blip on the radar. They're like, "Oh, you better, yeah, you're kidding, right? Like that's nothing." That he was tossing for 30 minutes. That's okay. Yeah, great.
and then I just saw Gwen Jorgensen just started a YouTube channel. I was just watching her first she's got, you know, Pat's there, she's got the kids there, and they're running this. She's doing this indoor track event. Yeah. Right, so you know, kid isn't but so old, a couple of months, right? Second, whatever race she was doing, she had got like the second fastest time in the world this year.
Yeah,
I'm like, how is this possible? How is this even possible as a new mother? But yeah, it's just like, okay, well, there's the other end of the spectrum.
Right. Yeah. Well, I didn't have the kid, obviously, so yeah. I'm just a mere mortal compared to Gwen, but. I've always been pretty impressed with her. She's an incredible athlete, and obviously I know her a little bit through Phil Guymon. Like I'm not friends with her, but I do know of her more than I would normally, and so it's been fun to watch her as well. And I'm sure she'll be doing just fine winning races, as you saw that second place. Yeah, I saw that as well. It's like, ooh, okay.
Yep. Well, I mean, you know, and more important for her, she's married to the former Minnesota cyclocross state champion, so
definitely there's a skill set coming through there for sure. For sure, big time. Always it always revolves back to cyclocross.
That's
everything.
that's right mm-hmm. So it's been a long time, at least on this on Crosshairs Radio, that we've caught up. A lot has happened in the last year or so, but let's just start with, I know you've talked about it, you had that great open letter and blog post about Aspire, but just maybe even reflecting back on this team. I mean, it was pretty ambitious to start, to go out on your own, start this team, start this program, to grow it to, even at a three-athlete team in today's climate environment, that's a big production, where we have so many people with privateers, plus, you know, you're out there as the primary athlete, but also finding the sponsors, also dealing with everything behind the scenes. You know, you've had a little bit of time now since then. What are the, you know, any new thoughts from the announcement that it's not going forward in the same format to where you're at now?
Definitely. I mean, I am still doing a lot of reflection and thinking about what's happening. When all of this stuff with the team started to sort of take shape, I was thinking a lot more about the staff and what I was going to do. And really, my decision came from a place of needing to stop what I was doing with the team because I couldn't secure everyone's future immediately, which maybe was like too cautious in some ways. So, you know, I'm sure there are teams and things like that are going forward that don't have all their sponsorship locked, but they know that, or they're hinging that they'll definitely get it. But our budget was pretty significant, and we lost a lot. And so that for me was where I knew, okay, this is, you know, there's too many holes to plug here, and I might not be able to pull this off. Like I've called in some favors. I mean, I've done everything that you have to do when you own a racing team to be able to keep it going. And that's, you know, you've asked sponsors. Like I would give one example of last year with Behind the Barriers. You know, with the Aspire Racing Edition, you know, I just asked all of our partners to put in another $1,000. just so I could have some amount of money to put towards doing the show again, because I felt really passionate about doing it. And of course, it's not the same as it was, and it's a different type of show, as well as, you know, it had a much lower production value than what we had done in the past. But I felt really passionate about that, and I found the money. I feel like I could always find the money, and I feel like I could reinvent the wheel or do something different or ask this staff to not come to this so that it would be less money. There's always a creative side to the budgeting, but the amount that we weren't able to secure immediately kind of really put me on my back foot. And I wasn't expecting it fully in that way with so much loss. And that's why I felt like I can't support these writers and the staff in a way that I feel like wouldn't be completely smoke and mirrors and kind of BS to everyone. You know, there's a certain point where you're like, yep, we're treading water and we're doing fine. And we hope to take on more sponsorship and we hope to do good work. But then there's not being true to yourself, which is that this team can't be run at a professional level without this amount of funding. And that's where I felt like I reached. And I still believe that if I wanted to like shake every tree and keep going, the thing is I've been doing this my whole life, is finding and procuring sponsorship. And this is sort of a bigger problem that I think you and I and many people have talked about in the sport, where I question the validity of the ability to market in this sport because of some of the things that are happening in it. And when I'm asking a non-endemic sponsor to come on, unless they're a European company or an endemic, right, meaning in the cycling world, I ask if the spend is a good enough return on investment for them. And that has been, when you're asking for a three-person, you know, seven or eight-person staff, team, you know, it's a good budget. And when I'm asking for that, what I found was that it, maybe the spend didn't match the return. And that was where I felt like I was going uphill. And those come from bigger, deeper issues that I see sort of coming into the sport with, you know, privateer programs and so on and so forth, is because the return on investment isn't there because of the way that some things are being run in the sport. And that's, unfortunately, that was just my experience. That's not for everyone. You know, that's not Stu Thorne's position, or maybe that's not Don's position and Raleigh Clement or whatever, but that's been my experience on trying to find sponsorship for our program this year. So.
And it ties in well with, I think, what we've been talking about recently, just because we have the Olympics going on right now. And that's, and you know, you on Twitter, you were out there saying, man, wouldn't it be great if cyclocross was in the Olympics? And I've come around to that. Like, I used to think, I don't see the benefit in it. And it's kind of interesting because it is a two-tiered approach. And I think that's something that you are looking at that could really pull in non-endemic sponsors, because now they're seeing it. It's like curling all of a sudden gets cool all, you know, this time of year, and people rediscover what it is where they haven't seen it before. And I'm sure that that's helped that sport tremendously.
Yeah. I think that's my thought, is there isn't a way right now that I see cyclocross being able to break out of the sort of, let's say we're on 2% growth, just again, hypothetically, just to use something. Well, if we were to use the Olympics, the amount of riders and countries looking at the sport as being a viable way to make a living, and companies thinking about it as a viable way to be a marketing tool for them, those would all come full circle, and the amount of coverage and things would just go up quite a bit. And so every 4 years we would have this monument to look forward to. And I think I see that as being that should be a huge priority if you're running the sport, or if you're thinking about the big picture of it. I just know that being an Olympian is obviously, like, selfishly the thing that I would have loved to have had the opportunity to do, and I think I would have had a chance if I had been if cyclocross had been one of the Olympic sports. But outside of that, from the sport and for the health of it, and for someone like you, even yourself, I mean, if there was Olympic coverage of this, it would be it would absolutely put gas on the fire and just let it run. I mean, it would be, there would be funding. There would be intense interest from all types of athletes. I mean, you know, even when I was at my peak, I was thinking like, man, maybe I should do BMX or you know, maybe I should do mountain bike or maybe I should do, because then you start thinking about it like, well, it's possible. It's because I want to go to the Olympics. That would happen for cyclocross. And I don't see how it would hurt us. And that's the thing. I think we're at a place where we need to have some growth, because it goes back to that other part of the conversation where it's what if I couldn't find the sponsorship, that means that there's not enough value, and how do we create more value? And I think that something like the Olympics could really create a lot of value. And so that would be, for me, that would just be, I think it would check a lot of boxes, and I think it would really ignite a lot of attention. So,
yeah. And the way, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot, and especially it started, and I've talked about this too much, but I'd like to hear your views on it. The national team that USA Cycling created, which, again, despite the criticism that I have, I think is awesome. And I think it's great that cycling athletes now have a barometer to measure what success is. And that it's all written out, and it says, if you meet these milestones, you will get this level of support, which is fantastic, you know, and that didn't always exist. And it was sort of done behind closed doors, and we're going to support these athletes and not these athletes. And nobody really knew what was going on. And that, especially when, you know, US cyclists were doing better in grand tours. And that was a big push. And there are a lot of Americans in road racing and in grand tours. But where you look at it, and you look at those BMX athletes, I had an opportunity to go to the national team launch and see them all. I mean, it's awesome that they have this opportunity. And the cool thing about them is that you would think those were the men and women who were like, hey, we're this fringe sport, and BMX is like this cool free, you know, whatever, freestyle, all this stuff is like this cool thing that we don't want the man to be in. They weren't like that at all. They were like, this legitimizes us. This gives us the respect that we want. You know, we're athletes, and now that we're in the Olympics, and for the US, they're like, hey, these are the guys winning and women winning medals for us. We need to support them, because that's where the money's coming from. So I think it's twofold. One, you introduce cyclocross to a whole new cache of people out there and to sponsors. And on the other half of it, you give our athletes the same support that other Olympic sports are getting. And I think that's huge too. And I look at like Belgium, and they have an incentive for their athletes to stay in cyclocross, right? Definitely. I mean, all the sponsors are there, all the money's there.
All the
coverage is there. You know how much they don't like leaving Belgium to race, and why would they? They don't have to, you know.
They don't.
So that's, I think, making it the Olympics might pull it out of that stranglehold and make it more global, and it allows other countries to enjoy that success as well.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And I think about that all the time. This idea of viability and longevity, and, you know, the development team model versus the professional model. It's when those guys were winning those tours, you know, they had $20 million behind them. They had a staff of people cooking, cleaning, shipping, logisticking, like what, everything for them to be able to perform at that level. And to think that you could get a world champion from a $12,000 stipend is absolutely insane. It's not that the sport and the disciplines of the sport have changed so much. And that's I think what I'm a little bit, that's my, you know, again, my smaller worry is that like the development team model is certainly there, or the privateer model is certainly there, but it's changing a lot, and it's constantly changing. Everything has changed. And I think that I wonder where these riders will go. And that's something that I think about with the Jam Fund. There's you know, the Jam Fund is a very small budget. We do it on really a tiny, tiny amount of money that we raise by design through our events that we have. And the Northampton Cycling Club and a couple of sponsors help us. But in general, that is a development team that runs on a very small budget. The question is where Stephen, Ellen, Jack, Anthony, all Duren, all of the riders that came through, where they end up. And they've all ended up somewhere. But I'm seeing it more and more where there isn't necessarily somewhere for them to go that's better and has that level that takes them from putting their own wheels on and cleaning their own bike and doing everything and bringing them to that level where it's show up to race. That is where everything changes. If you look at even someone like Spencer, when you put them in the position to be able to perform, they can when they're not using that other 25% of their energy that another rider is. So if you're on a pro team and you're performing and it all looks like, man, they got on the team and then they're just doing great, it's because a lot of stuff's being done for them now. And I think that's so important as a professional athlete to have that support system. And I worry that I've said this too, is that, you know, if you're not as entrepreneurial and you don't have this idea that you're going to set up your own, you know, privateer program and get your own mechanic and book all your own hotels and stuff like that, what if you're just a great cyclist and that's not your skill set? Or you're 19 years old. Those are hard things to come by. And I do worry about that. And that's part of why I would say, very reflective and a little bit sad that the team is ending, because we were trying to do things differently and really look after the athletes and create just like a fun and easygoing environment, but also with a kill in it. You know what I mean? Like not any different than a lot of teams. Of course, every team wants to do that. But I feel like with our team, to disband or to slow things down or to stop, it's a bit of a bummer, because I worry that the development model is what everyone thinks is, oh, that's plenty. And Jam Fund, it's not going to turn out a world champion necessarily, although, you know, it could, but it would be, you know, I think you understand where I'm going there. It's just the level of support that you have is really important.
Yeah, and you saw the success in the athletes that you brought on to Aspire. I mean, I think, to be honest, everybody was like, oh, Spencer Petrov, that's an interesting choice. And I know you had a, you know, relationship with him before, but boy, put him out there, and just from Rochester on, you're like, well, this guy obviously belongs on the squad and racing at the front of elite level events.
Definitely, yes. And I think, you know, there were a lot of riders that would have been suitable for the program, but I also know that a team is a group of people that need to be together all the time and enjoying each other's company, and I knew Spencer would fit that. So that's a part of putting together a group of people as well, is knowing how they'll all interact and expecting them to, yeah, be able to adapt and come into something that they, you know. So like for the team, for Spencer, like he didn't know what the team was like before because he didn't have the experience, but I knew from my interactions with Spencer that he would be just fine getting along with Ellen, and I knew that he and I got on, and I knew that Tom, our mechanic, and Brandon and Molly, I knew that everyone would be excited to have someone like Spencer's energy and I knew that we could help him and kind of bring down some of those things. But I do think that he showed himself. I think some of his rides this year were punching above his weight, but he showcased himself enough times that I'm really excited for the future for him, because I think he's one of the big talents that's coming out of the country.
Yeah. Just to get into the weeds for a second, because I mentioned Rochester and just having that – team dynamic with you and him up there in the was this day two or day one? I can't remember. It was day one, right? Where you was the three up sprint?
Yes.
Yeah. How much conversation going on between the two of you when you were in that? It looked like at one point you were given some stage direction.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know Spencer's level. We had trained and we had done some road racing together, and we had been spending a lot of time because he was in Massachusetts before the season started. But I didn't know really where Spencer was at. So I told him, let's close this gap up. And he was just going nuclear. And he looked at me and was like, no. And I was like, all right, cool. I'll go. I'm going across. But that's my whole thing was that I would I looked out for Spencer in as many races as I could to allow him to have his best performance. Even though I might have been able to be second in the race, I looked at Spencer and said, you know what? I want you to fight for second, and I will play my hand to help you. Like I always, because what does it matter if I get second or first at Gloucester again? Sure, it would have been nice, or sure, it would have been nice if I had won Rochester, but I also knew that there's strength in numbers, right? If Ellen's winning that race and Spencer and I are on the podium at these races, I looked at it differently, and I wanted to help bring confidence and excitement to his start of his season. So I was really racing for him a lot of the times when I was able to. That was the conversation. But at that point, this is all first time stuff, right? To get into the weeds. Spencer and I never raced together in that situation. So when we're going into these things, it's like, we're going to need to figure some stuff out. And that happened a bunch of times, like at Gloucester this year, it happened for sure. It did, where we had a plan and we didn't execute it correctly. And then Tobin ended up smoking us both, which, you know, it's time together and you only get a handful of those each season. So the amount of learning that happened this year for Spencer, I think, was phenomenal, and the way he thinks about certain things, I think, was really good for him. And I think it will help him in the future think about, like, I remember I've been in this situation before, and this is how I should think about this, or this is what, you know, Jeremy and I talked about, or this is what I did and it didn't work, so I'm going to try this. Whatever it is, he has his own intuition, but that definitely happened multiple times.
Yeah. Do you think back, just thinking about that in the team dynamic that you two were developing over this year, and your position in this more as the mentor, more as a guy that wants to set up and help someone else? Do you ever think about that and contrast it to your Cannondale days? You know, you and Tim and Jamie, that was such a powerful team with powerful personalities, and just where your position on that squad versus where you are now, and just that evolution.
That story is really similar to Steven and I, but yeah, with Tim it was a little different, because Tim looked out for me and taught me things, but he didn't look out for me. I it's hard, my memory might not be as clear. I consider Tim a good friend. I've said that before. I think Tim definitely was winning races for Tim, though. Like, that was...
Tim will be the first to agree with you on that.
Yeah, yeah. We were winning races. We were winning... It was really beautiful because all of us were on the podium and we were this powerhouse. We were just, you know, doing... We were just doing work. I don't even know how to really answer that question. I think Tim taught me a lot, and I think Tim has a unique skill set that I was able to learn from Tim's skill set as much as I was able to learn from his racing tactic.
Mm-hmm.
Tim would drop me. I mean, Tim would just, I remember one time we were at Southampton racing and I was in the front with him and he was national champion. And I remember he just rode me straight off his wheel on the last two laps. And I remember going home and being like, I'm never going to beat this guy. And I remember Stu Thorne telling me, Jeremy, you need to be patient. You know, everything's going to happen for you. And I try to repeat those things to someone like Spencer as well, because when you're in the box and you think that everything is, oh man, I'm not good enough or this or that. When I look at it, I see someone that's 19 that has thousands of races. Well, more than 1,000 races to go. And the way that I see things is totally different. So for both Ellen and Spencer, you know, I try to just deploy the best, like, advice that I was given and what I see and how I see it, because it is easy to get wrapped up in your own results. And you have to understand that, like, even with someone like Anthony or Dern, it takes so much time to develop the skills, and you don't know what they're going to reach or their level until for such a long time. Everyone's always improving and changing and becoming a better person, more mature and whatever. All of those things are constantly changing.
Yeah, looking at, you know, just sticking with this season that just ended, you know, you could see that and you working with Spencer, but then for you, it seemed like Pan Ams, Nationals, those were me races. Those were those were events that it seemed like you were keying on and putting all the eggs into those baskets. And you know, I have to say, and I don't think I was alone, when you were crushing it at Nationals, I don't know if this was going, I'm hoping it wasn't going through your head, but everybody else is thinking, ooh, Pan Ams.
Yeah.
Because we sort of saw the same scenario there. Obviously, it, you know, and thankfully it played out differently, but it was just interesting. I what I liked is that you still had the confidence and sort of the grit to still sort of pursue that same, that same, you know, game plan.
Yeah. That's how I like the race.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my plan for that race for Nationals was to isolate Tobin, or to get Tobin out of the picture, because no one beat Tobin in a sprint all year. If Tobin had gone to the line with Steven and I, or just me, or just Steven, he would have won. Betting, if I'm gambling, man, then he would have won, right? There, maybe he didn't, but Tobin won all the sprints that he went to this year. I don't actually believe that anyone beat Tobin in a sprint. So if you have a person that you know, that you have to make 60 hard minutes in order to, you know, in some cases, Tobin wasn't able to do the full 60 minutes if it was full gas. We saw that a couple times.
Yeah.
So if you look at that as being the only way to isolate him, then that's the tactic. But no one was taking the initiative, and I knew that that would be the case because it's a more tempered race, right? I want to play my cards late. I don't want to show too much. All these things. So I've had success at altitude from running a hard tempo from start to finish, and really the only person that was able to match that was Steven. And so I give him credit for that, and I'm not upset with my ride, and I'm happy for him. It's obviously, I would have liked to have won, but I played my hand and I played the cards that I was dealt. And I think had Pan Am's gone a little differently, had I not had that, I don't know how Steven would have gone through that race, right? Because I was in second at, you know, 5 to 10 seconds for a majority of the race, taking back time in certain sections and letting it go out in other sections. And I felt strong, like I felt like I was in a good cadence. But when I had the tachycardia happen in my heart, it just is too hard of a course to be like, oh, cool, I'm just gonna kind of do like this maneuver and chill for a minute. It's like,
yeah, there's nowhere on there to do that. Yeah,
no, there wasn't. It wasn't a place where you could do that. And so that race, I did have to stop, and I was nervous, and it took me 2 weekends of racing to get my head back around going hard again, because it was strange. I never had that happen, but at that level. But I think I would have still been second or in the mix for the win if that hadn't happened at that race as well. And so, yeah, sometimes I said, like, all right, I'm coming out to play. Like, this is going to be a race. Because I would have really liked to have taken a jersey this year. That was a goal of mine at the start. And I think I was, yeah, I think, you know, I know that things have changed since I was 29 or 30 when I was, like, absolutely in my peak. But I still know that I can put it together on one day. And those were the days that I decided that I'd try it. And there were other races I was really happy with. Charm City and the Gloucester weekends and, you know, even some races in Ohio. I think I did some good performances. Whether people look at those and think they were good or not, I don't know. But for me, I was happy with them.
Yeah, I think, a couple things. One, you know, just talking to other racers in your field at Pan Am, you had a lot of people worried, and they were like, holy cow, trying to stay on your wheel in that chase group when you were kind of pushing up the tempo. So that was that was impressive ride for that. And then what you said about Tobin's interesting, and I think we really saw that starting with Charm City, where it was more of a tactical race. And after that, when everybody's kind of figured out, you know, even the weeks after that, Gloucester and stuff like that, that everybody figured out the threat that Tobin was, is that tactic changed, and it really was, all right, we're going all out from the gun here.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of fun to watch that. And what I here, you know, followed up with this point, what I really liked about this season, and culminating in you and Steven, who are very close, yet it got a little nastier out there, and it sort of reminded me of cyclocross 10 years ago or so. It's like, you know, everybody seemed to be racing in the last couple years, and it was almost like friendlier. I mean, I'm not in there. I don't know. I could be completely wrong. But this year, they're definitely, and I think Tobin being good definitely had a part to do with it. Carey up there had a little bit to do with it. And then, you know, I think you came in there with something to prove, and that had something to do with it too. And it really added this level of excitement. I mean, nobody's racing dirty, but it just seemed more aggressive, and from a spectator standpoint, it was more fun to watch.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely for nationals, being on that spotlight, being a championship, and having that amount of coverage, I think was, I think that does add a little bit to people's ability to see the way that we can race.
Oh, that was a street fight, and it was fun to watch.
That's good. I like that. but this is, so I just want to say, you know, being me, that's why I believe so much in coverage. Because that excitement and that the amount of people that were able to see that street fight, as you said, which I think is cool. That is what sport is. And whether or not we're doing it in the fields of Europe for 13th to 17th, or we're doing it here in the States and we're going head to head for the win of a title, that coverage and that amount of that is such a big part of what I believe for the sport, you know, needing. Because those battles happen often. I mean, I look at something like Charm City, and that was a beautiful battle. You know, yeah. Gloucester was the second day with Tobin and I, it was a great battle. Like there were over the years with Treban and Tim, we had great battles, but we just didn't have the platform to showcase them. And they came out in a different way in a post-production setting with the shows and with, you know, stuff that you did and Cyclocross Magazine, everything. But that ability to watch it live like that, I mean, people have told me that they've gone back and watched the race again and hope that the outcome was different on the second time. Like, that's the thing is, absolutely, that was a phenomenal race and it was a fun one to watch for a lot of people. I just wish that we could showcase them all the time, because I think that those battles are what keeps people and sponsors and the momentum of the sport up.
Yeah, and just a point that I like to make from races like that, and you'd see it in like Niels and Sven like that, the one they're like definitely basically just like bashing each other, and it's very physical. I mean, you all were leaning into each other, they're, you know, blocking each other, elbows out, you know, and it was, and my point being, it's the thing that is always a good reminder for every amateur racer out there. A, you can do this stuff where it's part of racing and it's clean and it's just part of the sport. B, if somebody leans on you in a cyclocross race, that's part of racing. And it's not, sure, you know, we get people who are very sensitive, you know, they don't want to be touched, or they don't want to be, you know, they think somebody's taking their line or something in cyclocross. And I always sort of question that. I mean, some people do stupid stuff, but if it comes in, you know, fair play and racing, I mean, that's kind of the beauty of the sport.
I'll tell you one more quick story. Last year, before Pan Am, last year I got second to Steven at Pan Am's, and obviously it was a race that I wanted to win. And he also wanted to win it. He wasn't a national champion and he was looking for a jersey, and Pan Am's was the first opportunity for him after having such a dominant season to do that. So we're like, okay, so we get to like a week before, and I remember Al sent out an email that we were going to go to the sand pit and we were going to do some laps, and that if anyone wanted to come. And so Steven and I both, yes, we're going to go. And I remember Al texting me like, don't do it. Like, don't you two go out there and ride Pan Am's the weekend before, like on Wednesday before Pan Am's, and take yourselves out. And we went out there, man, and we absolutely annihilated each other. We were doing exactly what we were doing at Nationals, but it was such a whipping contest for sure. I have the files in my training page. My heart rate was as high as a race, and he won one of the 15-minute sessions, and then I won the other one, and then we were running, and I ran a section faster than him, and we both just went back. We were both eating clip bars, just looking at each other like, we're going to do this.
It was the Apollo Creed Rocky moment in the gym after the fight.
We're just beating the crap out of each other at some instant, the sand pit in West Hampton. I mean, it was, this one was in East Hampton, but you know, we've made each other better from it. And, that's really a beautiful thing, man. Like I can't, you know, Steven said it too, like we're different people, but I consider him a friend, and I'm not, I in no way, it's just different. Like I'm not, I wouldn't be upset anyone won. Obviously, it's just the goal of sport is to win. So yeah. I want to win. But I'm also, I've said this 1,000 times, I'm also not, like, I'm not unhappy for someone else, especially a friend, to win.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, that Nationals race, I think even without you winning, just the way that you all separated yourself from the rest of the field shows that, you know, you're still there. You know, that ability is not gone, you know? And I think that, you know, and I think that going back to Aspire and it not continuing is, and you are unwilling to say retirement, which I think is fair, especially since we're talking about how we're not really old either. You know, it's kind of a funny thing to think about, but what, you know, can you, after making that decision with the team, and, you know, a couple of weeks now have gone by, have you thought about that anymore? I mean, what you basically said, you're going to race, but you don't know what that's going to look like.
Yes, that's exactly right. I will definitely do some racing. I mean, I think for me, this is probably the, you know, all of our contracts are expired. They're over. I mean, not all of them. I have some that, you know, personally run a little bit through the summer and so on. And I have great relationships with some of the sponsors, and there's a lot of events and things that are coming up. Like my April, every single weekend is booked with a different gravel grinder or an event or sea otter or so on. I've got camps, and I've got, you know, I'm doing a tiny amount of coaching and like small things like that. I'm staying busy, and I'm working through some team stuff. And as I sort of look at, this is, you know, probably the more important thing, I'm looking at what opportunities exist. And I think if someone came to me and said, Jeremy, I really believe in the programs and the things that you're doing, and we want to be a part of it, then I would say, yeah, let's do that. But that hasn't happened. So the team model for me, I mean, that was the plan, right? The plan was to own the team and to do some racing next year and to take over some of the duties that our manager Molly was taking care of, and to sort of just keep on and create a good environment for Spence and Ellen to be in and keep the system going. But that's not how it played out. And now I have to turn back in and look at what I want to do. Is I really, over the last 2 years, have started to focus on the development side, and that came to Ellen and Spencer. And some of it came at my expense, but there was also other things like injury and stuff. And so I asked myself, how important is it if I were to win another race in the United States? Is it important to me to win 100 career races? I'm pretty close. Like, there are certain things that I thought, oh, I'll do that. I'm definitely doing that. Like, that's important. But is it important? Do I want to? I definitely wanted to win another national title. So I'm looking at a lot of things like goals. Like, what would my goals be? And initially, I always wanted to be on the podium of a World Cup. And something, I've had to let go of some of those things. And so then I like go back into my head, and I'm like, okay, can I make a good living from this? Can I be with my family? Does this match my reasons for doing this? And in some cases, I obviously the passion and my love for the sport is definitely still there. So I struggle with this. The bigger question is, what are you doing with this? And I think that we've inspired, we've documented, we've created, we've pushed. All of those things were things that I made my reasons to going out there and kind of, you know, just going full gas at 110% of myself. And because my life has changed and because of health and all these different factors, it seems like sometimes the writing's on the wall. Like, there isn't an abundance of sponsorship saying, like, we have to do this. This is the most important thing to us. We won't do anything. We have to work with you. And so that's important, because throughout my career, we did have an abundance of sponsorship and people that wanted to invest and be a part of what we were doing. So that has changed. And my ability to compete internationally is not the same as it was 3 years ago. And therefore, my ROI to a sponsor has diminished slightly. And I think that maybe people disagree with that. Maybe I do have the pull. Maybe I don't. But from my metric, which is measuring it with sponsorship and interest, it has changed. And can I push myself harder? Can I do things differently? Can I focus on number one? Yes, but I the thing that I would say is I've done that since 2014 when I took over Aspire, and I was looking for a change, which is why I added teammates. And now that that model's gone, I'm like, I don't know. So that's where that indecision comes from. And I hope that wasn't too long-winded or technical, but that's the truth. I started the team because I wanted to do something differently, and we did something differently, and now the team doesn't exist. And so going back to just being Jeremy Racing, that's not the reason to do it for me anymore. I don't have the I don't have to win every race because I feel like I checked those boxes. I feel like I won those races in front of my family and such, and that was the most important thing to me. And now I'm looking at, that's why I said slow things down, because I'd still like to do some racing and target some events that I do have a lot of passion for, like a national championship or a Pan American championship. But I'd like to also take it a little bit differently, because the team was the reason that I got out of bed, and I thought there was a lot of stories to tell, and that was what was inspiring me to push so hard and find that sponsorship. And now that's changed, and so so I'm changing with that reality, you know.
So on top of just straight racing, you know, you sort of mentioned about how you love the video component of the sport, or just in general to relate with people and sort of bring the sport to people. Any plans to do something along those lines? I mean, is that in the works, a Behind the Barriers moving on to something else, or is that just not even, without sponsorship, not even something you're thinking about at this point?
I'm thinking about all those things. I mean, I said to someone, I have plan A, B, C, D, E, F, probably even G. And I think once one door closes, then we move to plan B. And once plan B closes or opens, then we see what that opens, you know, what door is that. So I'm knocking on a lot of doors, and I'm exploring and seeing what, obviously, like, traditional jobs are available. I'm seeing what sponsorship is available, what people's interest level are. And I'm using my creativity to talk about some things that maybe I would also do. I think being more, besides my family business, I've never really worked for someone, and I've been entrepreneurial in a sense, but I was an athlete. And so I did some things during my time as an athlete that certainly were steps outside of what a normal athlete would probably do with their time or their funds. So I feel like I got an education in some of those things, but now I look at that and I think that might be, not that it's too much risk, that's not the word, but it's, I'm not looking to just jump into another huge project where I'm spinning myself upside down and kind of doing it for smoke and mirrors. Like, if I could get the funding to do something, then I would do it. And again, I'm working on that. I'm thinking like, okay, maybe let's see if this is possible. Let's see if this has value to a sponsor. Losing some long-term relationships isn't great timing for those things, if that makes sense. Like, if I had a long-term bike sponsor, then I would, which I did, but if I had a long-term bike sponsor, then I would say, like, hey, do you guys want to do version 2 here, or version 3, or whatever version we're on, with me, and in this way? And then they would say yes or no, and then whatever. But because I'm going to create a new relationship with someone, and again, I'm working on that, it's just, I think it takes time. That's what I'm trying to say. It takes time to develop and to try to get these things going. And I'll say this, right, for the whole thing. I don't feel entitlement to anything, and I don't think anyone deserves I don't deserve anything from any of these sponsors. I think I have a venue that I could open up, and it may play out to be that I continue to brand and continue to do things like in the sport that are fun and outgoing and put a spotlight on some of these. But I also know that might not be the case, and I may pull into a more traditional role moving forward, or something that's also impactful but in a different way that doesn't have me at the races every single weekend. So
you mentioned you're doing a little bit of coaching. Is that something that interests you? I mean, it seems, you know, it's definitely a crowded field out there, but you've obviously bring something to that others don't do. Do you think that that's something that interests you, or the type of person that is looking to coach, not just mentor in this is how life as a cyclocross racer works, but more you know, this is how you get better, these are get into the nitty-gritty?
I mean, it's really, you know, I don't think I'll have 30 clients. I don't think that, but I mean, really, I do have a formula, right? I have an opinion about how things should go. I think that I've learned and amassed enough knowledge. I mean, that's coming from camps. That's coming from, you know, doing like the book with you guys and just a years of experience. So to throw all that away would be almost, it's like a little disrespectful. Like we have this great skill set, and I love to track and look at like files and data and plan and think about what the schedule looks like. The conflict of going to Europe and being here and playing with things, and really, you know, Al Donahue is my great friend, and he's a coach, and we have talked about so many things around my coaching or around his and what he's doing. So I think that for me right now, I'm not openly like advertising, right? Like, hey, I'm coaching. I mean, you wouldn't be able to find a Jeremy Powers coaching article.
Yeah.
But I am. If the right person were to ask me, then of course I would consider it. I don't want to, you know, I do not want to just leave and be like, okay, cool. Now I'm working at company Y, right, and I've left everything. I feel very much attached to this, and it's a huge, I mean, if people don't understand that this is my passion and it's something that I've made my life around, then I don't know. I don't know what else I could have done.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if anybody has that, you definitely, I through all of this, I've never experienced anybody who has nerded out as much basically from the day their season end to what tweaks are going to make from little bit to just we're scrapping everything and we're starting fresh with this approach this year to the season, from when we're going to do races to how we're going to trade. I mean, it was pretty amazing just that evolution that you went through.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I think, you know, it's, you, there has to be some change, and there has to be a way to think about things differently and look at things differently. And I understand that my talent was my talent level. There wasn't like a way. The only thing that changed for me was getting older and then figuring out how. And I sometimes when I would look at or read Sven Nys interviews, I would see similarities that I didn't know he went through, but he did. And I think in my head, like, okay, yeah, he also had to reinvent himself in a way as he got older. The starts got slower. The races that he did well in got, you know, the window got smaller. Like, these are the races that I could do well in because these high punchy races with the younger riders. That all those things are things that I think about. But I also had a V8 and those guys had V12s is how I always talk about it. Like, there were some people that were more talented than I was. And I knew my role and I knew my place. And I knew that I wasn't going to win 50 World Cups like Sven Nys. But I also had my own things that I wanted to do, and I think they were important as well. And so reinventing them and continuing to push myself to be my best is, that inspired me, but I think it inspired other people as well. Whether it was whatever my best result was at a World Cup, I think it was sixth, or it was top tens in Europe, those were results that I tried really, really hard for, and that was my personal best. And so that's fantastic. Like, that's just as well, because that was first place for me. That was my first place and that's what we all want to do, you know? So someone might own a, whatever it is in business, they might own a $1 million business. But yeah, someone has a $250 million business, but someone that started a $1 million business, that's also a great achievement. And I never tried to minimize any of the stuff that I was doing. I just tried to focus on myself and be the best that I could be with what I had. And looking at different training techniques or different coaches or different methodology and formulas and ideas and diets. And I still love all that stuff. It's just, you know, the reasons that you do it always are changing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the diet stuff. Yeah. You definitely went through some different changes there as well from year to year. And I think that people, that's the kind of stuff that I think that, you know, just from the video you all produced, just to even the behind the barrier stuff, that I think that kind of was the intrigue of following you, because you thought so deeply about these things that it was that's what people dug. I do want to say, just to put a pin in the team things, you mentioned how one of your biggest concerns, especially with the sponsorships ending, was not to leave Spencer and Ellen out there with no time to figure out what to do. I think Ellen has intimated on social media she's got an announcement coming up, so she's kind of ready to roll and taken care of. Any word on Spencer and what he's thinking?
Yeah, there's a lot of interest in Spencer. I mean, I say a lot. There are a couple of programs that have reached out. I'm more than confident that Spencer is going to have a good team to go to, and he has people that want to help him and invest in him as well as I do. And I would not let Spencer, if Spencer didn't have anything, then I would absolutely go to bat and find a way to make sure that he had the support that he needs to be able to keep on. It's not past me to find and put together something and create a small program for him to be a part of. I would do that in a heartbeat, because I said I would, and whether that was through the Jam Fund with some additional support, right? I would have found a way to make sure that Spencer had what he needed to be able to keep on the trajectory that he has, because I've invested in him and because I believe in what he's doing. But he's going to be totally fine as well.
I know Worlds wasn't the result you were hoping for, but we all got to watch. That's an understatement, I know. Thank you. We got to watch it on TV, and it just looked, even from the junior men might have had the worst conditions, and it looked insane there. And seeing all the preview videos of people warming up, just give us a little, boots on the ground thoughts on that venue and just that whole event. It just seemed nuts.
It was absolutely nuts. Boots on the ground is like, it was, I mean, when I first saw it, I didn't see it until, I think I might have saw it the first day, Thursday, and then I didn't go back until Saturday, because I just knew it was going to get even worse and worse and worse, and the lines were going to get too deep. I mean, in one of the lines, one of the disc rotors was hitting like a rock that was deeply buried in there and like scuffing the disc rotor. That's how deep the rut was. And then on another rut, they had to cut the tree roots so that you could actually get in the line because it had gone down so deep that inch and a half, tree root was impending the way that the line threw you and sending people into the tape. That's a level of like mud and on and off the bike that none of us had seen in a long time. And so extraordinary circumstances created extraordinary results in some cases. Like, I think Woot really benefited from having that running. I think that he either programmed his training more towards that day to day, or he's just naturally better at it. But you could see that his cadence in the running was just on another level, and the truth is his coach Niels was a fantastic runner as well. I remember doing races with Niels where he would just troop, he could get off there. He was running looked like 4 minute mile pace, just going.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that from where I see it, if you had told me that the race would be like that, I would not have done power interval training. I would have just done running training with like high end work, which was the exact opposite. I was training for a race that was going to be really heavy power. I was thinking like 15 to 20 second run up that hill. That was the only thing that I was planning for. And I'm not naturally a gifted runner. That's not my strong suit, just straight out of the box. So I personally would have trained differently completely. I wouldn't even have bothered hitting an interval, because I would have known that my race would have been in 30 second to 1 minute efforts, and it would have been in low cadence and like fast running,
Yeah, I mean, so, I think Katie said the same thing. She was like, and Mark, they were like, well, they didn't train for, they hadn't been able to do their run training coming into there, and we're just sort of hoping that it wasn't going to be a run heavy you know, event, and just, of course, it didn't turn out to be that way.
Yeah. And the Europeans just tend to be better at it because a lot of their races have a lot of running in them naturally. You know, they do end up doing quite a bit more running throughout the season, and it's a part of their training that needs to be there day to day. Whereas when you're one of the riders from the States, you were like, well, I could focus more on motor pacing and speed work because we don't ever run and because I'm not going to Europe. So, you know, they bring the running on later in the year, but that's just not enough.
Yeah.
And that is a huge disconnect between how do we race at that international level. It's, you know, we don't have a lot of races that require the same things that the European ones do.
No.
So when we're going against obviously a bigger pool of riders that have deeper talent level naturally, right? That Europeans have 1,000, we have 100 people to pick from for our top talent, just speaking, and then they have the best riders. So then they're also doing these things, and then we're flying over the beat of them. You can see how you see the big differences. So.
Yeah. Even a guy like I remember when he was first year in the elites, or even as a junior U23 in the elites, Michael Van Tornout.
Yeah.
In a muddy race off the bike, like there were guys still trying to ride, and he was sprinting. Again, it was like you were saying with Niels, like 4 minute mile esque. I mean, just like,
yes,
putting time between him and people on the bike, just with the bike on his shoulder, just all out sprint for what seemed like a quarter of a mile. Just. Insane. And of course for him it paid off at that world as well, again that second place, but man,
I was gonna say the person that I thought about that should have been there truthfully was John Page. John Page should have been there. He would have done phenomenal. Like that was his thing.
Yeah,
that was that old Swiss cyclocross, just on off boom boom. He would have done phenomenal there, even with, you know, being 40 years old.
Yeah.
And
yeah, yeah,
being on the end of retirement, he still would have ridden a better race than he probably would have ridden in the top 30 of that race, just to say it.
Sure.
This is the truth. He's good. That's, you know, when you're good, you're good. Like that's your thing. Yeah, that's your thing.
So I guess the thing that everybody is all up in arms now, and I don't know, worth bringing up or not. What do you think? Give me your thoughts on Katie Compton's knee.
Oh, Katie Compton's knee. I actually have a tweet drafted, but I didn't send it yet.
Yeah.
I think it's really easy for the UCI to implement the change for just having the rounded rotors. I did a video that some people would have seen, and maybe you saw it, but I put my hand on a rotor going, you know, as fast as it could go in the stand with a 53-11, and then I just slowed it down with my hand. You know, I was thinking that when we were doing the races, like, why is the UCI not just putting their hand on these rotors to make sure that they're rounded? Because you can minimize all of the risk with a rounded rotor. I mean, no, that's not true, actually. You can minimize a lot of the cuts that we're seeing are cuts like that one that Katie has.
Yeah.
And it's again, it's 1 out of 1,000, but 1 out of 1,000 is still, there's still a risk. And so if you can take that and cut that down to 1 out of 10,000, we should do that. Whereas,
I guess,
you know,
I should jump in here and say, because I didn't really give a setup for that for people that don't know, you know, the last race of the season for Katie, she got into a crash and a rotor like basically severed her knee. I mean, down to the bone, pretty nasty cut.
Yeah. Discs aren't going anywhere, so it's our job to make sure that the ones that the discs that we're using and the way we're using them is safe.
That
I think about it.
It used to be, you know, what it was 5 years ago when the fun game was to count where the first, you know, how many people were on disc brace and where they were in there in the top 10. And da-da-da. I mean, I think this year it was, oh, look at Francis Moret, the one guy not on disc brakes.
Right.
Yeah,
that is funny for me because I was one of the first riders to bring them to Europe. I remember me and Tim and Simon Zahner were like three of the first guys, and then Kevin Powell's was using them a little bit in the next season, but like on and off, you know, and then Sven obviously, you know, put a lot of gas in that fire, and then you just started to see it. Like that was the exception was having Candy. Like, oh yeah, that guy's not riding disc. It's so strange. Disc is just a good system for cyclocross. It makes a lot of sense, and it's a better, as we've switched to disc, the courses have become more technical and harder, and that has been probably for me the most interesting thing, is that a lot of things that we were coming into when I first started 10 years ago racing, and like let's say 2007, things that I was doing then or things that were happening, like jumping barriers and, you know, doing these types of obstacles or riding up this hillside or whatever, or looking at stuff, that is like the bare minimum now. Now we've gone, like, now we're crossing it up, going over the bridges, you know, as like the thing that's like, holy crap, like he's completely X'd up going over the bridge and landing it on the other side, you know, like barely having enough bridge to clear. Those things, you know, jumping the barriers is like, if you're not doing it, what are you doing?
Yeah, it's gone. I mean, I've pointed it out before. It's gone from a novelty to an essential skill.
That's right. And so many things in our sport have gone that way. And if you don't change with it, then you're out the back. That's the truth. Like these jumping these gaps and going off of, things have changed.
Even in your own evolution, where you were one of the first guys, at least in the U.S., who was, and I say this purposefully, riding the barriers, as in putting your front wheel on the barrier, riding the barrier. That's gone too now. Like that's too slow. Yeah. Like if you're touching the barriers, you're going too slow.
That's true. It's absolutely true.
The other interesting thing, because I know it's something that you always talk about, that I just wanted to get your just before we leave Worlds, was that 2-inch strip of grass at the top.
Yeah,
that seemed like that was, everybody was sort of shooting for that, yet with those the metal barriers with the legs sticking out, it was sort of the end of a lot of people too. Seeing that, and I was kind of thinking about you, because you're always like, that's one of the things that you preach is like, look for the green. I'm like, well, there's the green and there's 3 inches of it.
Yeah, well, and the thing about looking for the green there is that you looked for it and then you found it the next day when you looked down at your knuckles and they were swollen because you wailed the metal posts with your hand. Yeah, me, Lane Maher, and Spencer were all sitting at breakfast the next day as we were flying home, and we were all looking at our hands. I'm still, right now as I talk to you, I'm looking at a huge gash on my middle knuckle because I wailed it looks like I got in a bar fight. I mean, it's huge. And Lane's hand was swollen. I mean, that's how you're really looking for the green when you decide that you're going to take your knuckle and hit it on a metal post at 15 miles an hour. It's like, oh.
Yeah, no, it
hurts.
Just,
big time.
It seemed crazy. Yeah, how much you riding your bike these days? Oh, it must be nasty weather.
Yeah, I've been riding. I've been riding. I've been working out every day. Actually, yeah, I've been taking the dog for a lot of hikes. I've been doing 90 minutes. I mean, I'm working through a lot of team stuff right now. Still, like tying up things, getting our last newsletter out. You know, figuring out equipment, getting things back, sending things out. I have, usually at the end of the season, I send out a lot of jerseys and gear and things that people have asked throughout the year, and I kind of get caught up on mail and stuff. So I'm busy and I'm making time at least 90 minutes a day to work out. It's important, I think, for everyone to work out as they stop. One of the things that we've evolved, as talking about Al, you know, Al and I talk about training and coaching and like stuff like that all the time. One of the things that we figured out is that we can't just stop riding at the end of the season. It just, if we just cold turkey it, we all go a little bit crazy, and it's not, we don't think it's really good for the overall like mental capacity of everyone in the community. Like we all are like, eh, we're kind of bummed out. Like we're not riding. We're not doing anything. We're just going to get fat. Like nothing. So this year I'm like, no, we're just not stopping. But I'm not going out and doing intervals, but I'm going to keep a good level of fitnessing, in all the ways, whether it's snowshoeing or skiing or riding my bike. They say it's going to be 58 degrees here on Wednesday or Thursday. So I'll probably do a big ride on Wednesday or Thursday.
Nice.
That'd be great. So.
Yeah, I think we're getting the same, except it's gonna continue to rain, which it hasn't stopped here for days. But
it's the weather here is crazy.
Yeah, I think that was pretty much. I'm gonna say that was everything that I had on my list, as if I actually had a list. I think got a little over an hour. I think we've covered a lot, and it was awesome catching up with you. Anything else out there you dying to talk about?
No, I think we're good. Our grand fundo is July 14th. If anyone's in the area and they want to come out, by all means, that will happen again. That's how the Jam Fund exists. So if you like gravel and you want to come out, join us on July 14th. And
Where can people find out more information about that?
Grandfundo.com.
Awesome.
The most American way to say Grand Fondo is Grand Fundo, so I picked it.
You know that and people now, this is the measure of a successful event is that you will find people saying that unironically for normal Grand Fondo. So that's a huge marketing win right there.
I always think of like pickup truck driving, like old school guy being like, I gotta go to that Grand Fondo. Gotta go to the Grand Fondo. Like, I think about like someone like Brad Huff saying that. Like, if he didn't know what it was, that would be how he would say it. Like, if he wasn't a cyclist and he didn't know, that's how he would say it. So I figured, you know what, we'll just make it real American and we'll just go with it.
Awesome. All right, Jeremy Powers, it was great to catch up with you. Next time we're gonna do this, it's not gonna be such a long gap between podcast episodes.
Bill, thank you so much. Thank you for everyone for listening, and thanks for everything that you do.